Remember hanging out at the shopping mall with your friends? If that's not really a your generation kind of thing, let me give you a feel for what you missed.
Being at Old Orchard Mall kind of reminded me of being home in Africa, by the watering hole, and the animals are in heat.
Jessica, you look great. Are you doing something different, or just hanging out with skankier friends?
That kid is back on the escalator again.
In a place like this, they can comparison shop.
Everybody could hardly wait until the mall opened.
Said Margie Ortiz.
I go there just about every weekend, so the two of the other girls from work.
See? I told you.
I don't know where these rites of passage are happening right now. Maybe the internet, but once upon a time, we drank Orange Julius's by the Sunglasses Hut before trying on clothes at a store called Units, where everything in the store could be mixed and matched in seemingly infinite combinations, and we liked it. Now, most of the indoor shopping malls in our area have either shut down or turned into shells of their former selves, with a couple of really notable exceptions. So how do you draw people to those spaces? A new trend involves art. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're going to hear more about that now with Dave Claflin. He's a marketing consultant for many Kansas City shopping malls. Hi, Dave.
Good morning.
Did you hang out in malls yourself growing up?
That was part of my generation. That's true.
How did you come to be the go-to guy for marketing the revival or repurposing of shopping malls in Kansas City?
Right place at wrong time, I guess. I've been involved in marketing and specifically marketing shopping centers since probably 2003. And over those last 20 years, there have been a big change in the way people shop. Obviously, the internet it was portended to spell doom for brick-and-mortar shopping for many, many years. It didn't happen. It didn't happen. It still hasn't happened. But it has impacted a big change in the way people shop, and that's precipitated a way in shopping malls are merchandised and designed.
So what's the deal with the art projects I've been hearing about?
So art is kind of a new idea that's not a new idea. You go back all the way to the Plaza Art Fair, started in 1932. Ward Parkway has been hosting the Midwinter Art Fair since 1963, and it's still going strong. And shopping centers have always looked for ways to get people to come in, spend more time, draw in customers that wouldn't otherwise come in. It's just become more critical now as entertainment, food, and beverage have taken over a big chunk of the market share of what's driving those consumers.
So what are some of the specific malls in Kansas City that are starting to look at art, and how are they looking at art? What's happening?
Well, a couple recent examples that I can think of, Independence Center had a local art group come in and design their pillars. They added some art to that. It's a great idea. It makes it interesting. It takes it kind of an antiseptic white space and makes it interesting and colorful, ties it to the community. And then on a kind of more commercial but also equally relevant tact is Wonder Wonder at Oak Park Mall. It's kind of an indoor selfie space, constantly evolving art installations that invite you to come in and get your picture taken or take it yourself in a unique environment that you're not going to find anyplace else.
You know, that's funny because that makes me think of the photo booths that used to be in a lot of shopping malls. And of course, those are still popular and you see them in various kinds of places. But so the new photo booth involves an artistic backdrop, something that makes it could only be here.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, drive around town and you'll see all these painted walls. They're gorgeous art. We're putting one in at Ward Parkway this fall. Big murals. Some are crazier and some are more mainstream or informative, but they're all inviting people to come get their picture taken in front of it, and they want to be a Kansas City icon and the kind of place that a visitor or a regular wants to come by and get their picture taken.
It's interesting because when I think of what the sort of appeal of malls seemed to be in maybe the late 80s, there was a sense of a mall wanting some centerpiece that was unique, but beyond that centerpiece, maybe it was a fountain of some kind or a light display or I don't know, like a, there was some feature usually that was unique, but beyond that, the mall didn't seem to be trying to be someplace. It was trying usually to be any place. It was trying to be what any mall would be, no matter where you went.
Right, a place of commerce. And the retailers did the merchandise did the job of drawing in consumers, because when I was a kid, the only way to find out about the latest fashions or what things looked like was to actually go to the brick and mortar and see it. Now my kids can shop online and they know all the fashions before they go there. You go back 10 years or so, the average merchandise mix in a shopping mall for entertainment and food and beverage was only 10%. It was thought that if you had too much entertainment and food and beverage, you'd be out of whack and you wouldn't be able to sustain the business. And now that percentage is looking more like 25-30% because those are the things that are drawing the consumers in and they're doing more surgical shopping rather than just running through the whole place.
Surgical shopping.
Yeah. They come in looking for these three items that they found online. They want to see what they look like when they're try them on themselves, and they're ready to buy. And shopping malls are looking for ways to get those people to stay longer and visit more shops and expand their reach.
You know, in the 1990s and early 2000s, artists were moving into abandoned spaces in industrial parts of cities, including Kansas City, spaces like old brick warehouses. There was a sense of grit, and maybe that was romanticized, and it was easy to romanticize this sort of other time period and the space that represented it, because none of us lived through that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I am struggling a little to have that same romantic sensibility around the suburban shopping mall. And maybe that's because it was sort of a mundane part of my own lifetime. Know what I mean?
Exactly. And like you mentioned, they were all designed to be somewhat homogenous. You could go city to city and not be sure what city you were in, because the indoor shopping mall looked fairly the same. And along the In the early 2000s, a trend came in shopping centers to do outdoor lifestyle centers. And those centers had landscaping and hardscaping. The Legends Outlets is one that had a lot of benches and green spaces, places for customers to linger. That shopping center has a great deal of public art in a more permanent fashion, all designed around Kansas historical themes. But with the same purpose in mind, to get you to stay longer and spend more time. And so during this transition, these spaces were trying to come out of an antiseptic, homogenous place and become more unique and inviting. There's still a blurring of lines. We think of the Crossroads as the center of Kansas City art. We don't think of it as Ward Parkway Shopping Center.
But that's now. We didn't think of the Crossroads that way 30 years ago.
Exactly. We were scared of the Crossroads. They were a big abandoned empty space. Exactly. And I think the thought is that if you've got a public place, it can be anything you want it to be, as long as it's a positive for the tenants and the mall management.
So, but looking back, you know, there are a lot of malls that got torn down in recent memory to make room for new development to remove blight from their communities. These big abandoned structures were creating blight. Bannister Mall, Mission Mall, Metcalf South. Is it your sense that we did lose? I mean, you talk about a public space can be anything we want it to be. Did we lose something, or is there this sort of natural making way for something else?
I think it's more the latter. There's a, just a natural movement of things. People think of a shopping mall as a static environment. Oh, it's open and these are the tenants, but really it's a living, breathing thing. Tenants come, they go, the trends come and go, certain retailers rise and fall. And the goal of the shopping mall is to keep lots of people going there. The more people they have going there, the better the retailers do. The better the retailers do, then the better retailers want to be there. It's a positive trend. If you're on the downward cycle, it's the opposite. People aren't visiting, the retailers don't want to stay there, and they end up somewhat abandoned.
Call in if you have thoughts about what we could do to breathe new life into shopping malls and whether you even find these spaces useful or if you think it's time to move on from malls. 816-235-2888. Basically, would you go see art in an old shopping mall? I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're hearing about a new trend of bringing new life to old shopping malls through art. And it's not uncommon for artists to move into spaces that are ready for some kind of revival, but the shopping mall isn't maybe the kind of space a lot of us associate with art, creativity, and, I don't know, uniqueness. It's that's not what they were going for when they were built. Anyway, my guest is Dave Claflin, and we are talking now about Dave. You know, we were just discussing all of the different projects going on in malls, but I wonder if there's a specific image that you can describe that really like explains how a mall can become someplace that looks unique.
You've stumped me. If you just look around, I mean, the Country Club Plaza was built in the 20s, kind of the first outdoor open air lifestyle center. And that architecture, it's almost 100 years old and it's terribly unique. And the different stores and restaurants come and go, but the architecture, the fountains, the art that's built into the landscape around it remain, and it's always been somewhat unique. So I think that's a great example.
But we're talking really about indoor malls.
Okay. An indoor mall, like we were talking about before the break, a lot of them were designed somewhat homogeneously, and you can take – so we've got like this midwinter art fair, and this summer we had a summer art fair at Ward Parkway. So now we're doing two art fairs a year. It's a temporary installation. It livens up the place. It brings artists are looking for ways to share their art and their talents, and it kind of brings a new life to an indoor space like the Ward Parkway Shopping Center for a temporary time. But then you've got a place like the Independence Center that has done a more permanent installation by painting those columns, those 40-foot columns they have there. And that'll be something that continues to make that place unique.
I'm guessing that, you know, the issue of abandoned shopping malls or shopping malls needing a new identity, like that's sort of the two directions that they've gone. And so the ones that need a new identity nationwide, is art sort of nationally something that people are looking to? Because I'm guessing that as a consultant, you've looked at examples of what's worked and what hasn't all over the place.
That's absolutely true. And yes, art is a national trend. As the retail environment has become more and more challenging, there's more and more competition from online shopping. shopping centers have had to get more creative with ways that they are merchandising their centers. What are the retail centers there? What are the restaurants? But also, what are the attractions? And art is absolutely at the forefront of it on a national perspective. And if you don't evolve constantly with a shopping center, you tend to get left by the wayside.
Are there physical features in these sort of 70s, 80s, 90s malls that are interesting for artists to work with?
Well, it's almost so out that it's in again. I think there are some interesting features, and each one would be somewhat unique.
But give me some examples of things that you typically find in these spaces that you find artists are kind of excited to work with.
Well, a lot of times there's a big empty space, a big empty wall, like the columns in Independence Center, these big white columns. That can be very interesting to an artist. It's a new challenge. I'm positive that those artists were never asked before that project to go come up with the design and paint a 40-foot column.
40-foot column. So what have you seen in your research? What have you seen happen in a mall where, like, you have a really great example of this is something you point to when you're talking to people at malls about this is an option for you?
I think they're all just tools in the quiver or in the toolbox. I don't think there's one thing that will automatically work at every shopping center. And even if you do a phenomenal job with tapping into some local zeitgeist and bringing in art and making it exciting, if the merchandising of the tenants doesn't support that, then the mall isn't successful.
So have you seen it not be successful?
I have definitely seen malls not be successful. It is more likely that if a mall is open to reaching these avenues and really pushing the boundaries, they're going to find success because they're showing that they're open to this change and the evolution.
What is your real hope as you look forward at the future of malls in Kansas City? I mean, you're the consultant, so you obviously are in it with the idea that these malls, you want them to succeed. But what does the picture of success look like to you? I mean, give me the picture of what you're looking at when you project 10 years down the line, what you'd like to see when you walk into Ward Parkway Mall, Oak Park Mall, places like that.
Well, I think continuing along with the theme that each of these spaces takes on a separate identity and becomes a little more unique. And I think we're finding that as retail tends to move along its evolutionary path. We're finding different restaurants. If you went back 20 years ago, there'd be the same restaurants at every single one of these shopping centers. And today they're going to be more and more unique. And I think you'll continue to find that trend of uniqueness.
Let's talk to Josh in Kansas City. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
What do you want to share?
I really find this to be a fascinating idea. And actually, the first time I encountered it was about 2009 at the Crestwood Mall in St. Louis. And I just happened to walk in to the mall, and I was really dumbfounded by the idea. I thought it was amazing. I think a lot of the shops had been converted into like art galleries, and I went into an old Hot Topic, and I noticed that it had been changed very dramatically, and so I was really inspired. I ended up communicating with the people who had organized the transformation. Sadly, the Crestwood Mall has been, I think, demolished at this point. And so I noticed that something about the model seemed to have not worked. And I was curious about the idea of art, which I think has been somewhat devalued in our society, being a way to bring more value to another thing, which seems to be kind of devalued, which is the mall. So I was just curious how you would respond to that kind of balance. And if you had any experience or knowledge about what didn't work at Crestwood Mall in St. Louis.
Okay, thanks for that call, Josh.
Josh, I think that's an excellent point. I'm not familiar with Crestwood or what they did specifically, but you bring up a really important point that the economic model has to be sustainable for the shopping center to just turn over 100% of their space to artists or an art installation obviously isn't going to keep the lights on there. Shopping centers measure their success in sales per square foot. So packing in a shopping center wall to wall with a fabulously high achieving stores is the ultimate model for success. But you need to, in most cases, that's not going to be realistic. So you have to find the combination that's going to allow both art and commerce to coexist.
Dave Claflin, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
In just a minute, we'll be visiting with one of the Fab Five from Queer Eye. Anthony, the food expert, is back in Kansas City with a cookbook, and it's a cookbook that tells snippets of his life story through recipes. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. When the Netflix series Queer Eye came to Kansas City, the Fab Five met a guy named Wesley Hamilton. He's been in a wheelchair ever since a gunshot wound left him with a spinal cord injury, and the way he's transformed his life since that incident is amazing. Wesley's gotten over some serious depression, partly by working out a lot, but he's been limited in the kitchen.
I love to cook.
Enter Queer Eye's food expert, Anthony.
What's the thing that you're not able to do right now in the kitchen that you would love to? Like, what's the dream?
Maybe cooking more of a variety of foods. You know, food is medicine.
But it's medicine. Doesn't it make you a happier person when you eat a good meal versus a food coma?
What I love about this clip is you can hear Anthony's enthusiasm for the food gospel he preaches. It's totally genuine, almost childlike in how unpretentious it is. If you watch Queer Eye, I think you know exactly what I'm talking about. Well, for all the Anthony lovers out there, he's out with a new cookbook, and it's surprisingly autobiographical. He tells his own story through food in this book, and he's back in Kansas City for a book release event tonight through Rainy Day Books. It is sold out, but if you don't have a ticket, never fear, because he's in our studio right now. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Anthony Porofsky, I'm so glad to have you.
Thank you so much for having me, Gina. I'm getting emotional listening to Wesley's voice being in Kansas City. It's the second or third time I come back since we wrapped filming, so it's a lot of great stories that and experiences that I had here over the, I guess, almost 4 or 5 months that I lived here.
Yeah,
during
you were
filming.
Here a while.
Yeah.
So would we be overstating it to say this is like your second home?
It kind of is.
I don't mean to put words
it's
in your
not,
mouth.
It's not, but it was really, you know, I'd have conversations with Tam sometimes, and whenever we film in a city, he makes fun of me because I always furnish the apartment as though it's a home, but I kind of make it a little weird and crazy. Like, I put a lot of trees and I like toys like Transformers and G.I. Joes and Star Wars figurines because I want to make it kind of like playful and fun and like I want to feel cozy. And Tan keeps it like very sterile, and he's like, I'm here to work and like have awesome experiences, but like Salt Lake City is my home. And for me, I'm like, no, I have to feel comfortable wherever I am. So it's a lot of candles and trees and
Transformers.
Yeah, and Transformers. Yeah.
This book really does tell your story through food, and we'll get to the recipes, but I want to start where the book starts, with a very personal reckoning, your own reckoning with crippling self-doubt in the form of imposter syndrome.
Yeah, I think it's pretty incredible. I mean, just in the few days that the book has been out, I've been kind of surprised at how many messages, and like whether it's Twitter or Instagram, I get of people who can relate to that. I think it's something that we've all experienced in some way, shape, or form, and continue to as well. I don't think it's something that necessarily fully goes away, but I just kind of have learned to embrace it and know that it's there, and sometimes like use it to help me strive to just constantly be learning. I'm inherently curious. So I don't see that as ever ending, hopefully. But I think self-doubt comes with anything. It comes in relationships. It comes in work. Even like family dynamics. It doesn't discriminate.
That feeling of being like a kid playing dress up instead of the adult who's really doing this.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you though tell me like the form it took for you as you got the gig on Queer Eye, which is like great news, such exciting news.
Yes.
And then suddenly,
boom.
You're feeling.
Yeah, it came moments later. After the excitement just sort of wore off, I was left with that. It was like, you know, when you get food poisoning and you get this like chill and it's like, am I really hot or really cold? It was kind of like that sensation, minus a lot of the other things that ensue. But anyway, we're not here for TMI.
But we kind of are.
But
Go
we
on.
Kind of are. It basically like, well, Queer Eye, you know, like just the title itself. I remember when friends of mine were asking me this, what show I'd booked and why I was moving to Atlanta for a few months. And, you know, we weren't supposed to talk about it, but to best friends, I would always, like, you know, say what I was doing. And I would, like, whisper the word Queer Eye because it's still, like, I didn't feel, part of me, I think, didn't feel like I was gay enough because it was just assumed that I was 100% gay. Not that, I don't even know if anybody is, or maybe some people identify that way. But for me, I've always been more along the continuum in terms of how I identify and been in more relationships with women than men. And so that part, I kind of felt like an imposter there where it was like, oh, like, well, am I, you know, gay enough? Whatever the hell that means. Whatever the heck that means.
No, that's fine.
Okay. whatever the heck that means to be on this show. And then the second part, obviously, you know, during the audition process, there were a lot of like legit chefs. There were chefs de cuisine. There were people who went to culinary school and like I went to university, but I studied psychology. It had nothing to do with food. So was I enough of a food person to be on the show? And some days, you know, I would wake up and be like, you know what? I am, because I'm a messenger and I'm somebody who loves to learn about food. And I don't want to be like an intimidating or imposing figure on a lot of these heroes. And I want to make it accessible and simple and easy. And then other days, I'd be hard on myself and be like, no, well, I'm not trained enough to be doing this. Like, I don't have the accreditation or whatever to have this job. And it really, but it depends like how I feel in the morning when I wake up usually. Like sometimes you feel good and other days you feel sorry for yourself. And when I feel sorry for myself, I tend to catastrophize. And then I just look at like, I find every single little thing that I can be nitpicky and critical about. And I tend to snowball.
Yeah, and you have had to deal with this in stages. There's always been, there was an article in the Washington Post that talked about this too. There's been this chatter that you've had to contend with over the simplicity of recipes that you sometimes share. And of course, you are sharing recipes not to show off your skills,
right,
but to help people learn to take care of themselves through food.
Yes.
And you know that deep down, but I'm sure that hasn't helped.
No, I mean, yeah, you're absolutely right. I think at the beginning I made a conscious effort. None of the recipes were decided until I met the hero, and it continues to be the case. Because when you meet these people, a lot of them, like, they don't remember the last time they've actually prepared a meal for themselves or anybody else. And you have to take that into account. I'm not there to intimidate them with something that they're never going to make again or that they're going to be scared of.
Or use a gadget that they don't have.
Exactly. Like, I'm there to support them and to make them feel like champions. Like, they're our heroes. We want to show them in their best light and get them excited about cooking. And it takes baby steps. It's like when I started, like, I messed up a lot of eggplant parm and roasted chickens and pasta dishes. And like one of the first times I boiled pasta, I remember putting regular pasta into cold water and I didn't understand that it had to be boiling and be very salty to flavor it so that you can then use the pasta water to emulsify a sauce. Like I didn't know any of that. And I just sort of figured it out as I went along.
I love that something as simple as boiling pasta that you can relate to the person who is new even to that.
Of course. And I forget too. I mean, even in the episode with Wesley, we were sitting there in this kitchen, and at one point I smashed a garlic clove and the skin came off, and then I moved it over to the side. And I did that three times, and I didn't clock the fact, because I was trying not to cut my hand, I didn't clock the fact that he was staring very intently as I was doing that. And then our exec, Rachel Mendez, pulled me to the side, and we do this little trick where it's sort of like, oh, Anthony, we need to check your mic real quick, which always means like, oh, did I screw up? Did I forget to say something? Is there a point that I haven't made? And I went out into Video Village, which is the room where everyone is sort of watching. And she was like, you have to do that again and you have to explain it to him. I was like, which part? I was like, I'm going step by step with this. And I've gone through the whole methodology. She's like, no, the crushing of the garlic. I was like, oh, no, I just removed the skin. And then I made and I explained how to do the paste. She was like, yeah, but if you saw the expression on his face when he saw you just pound that garlic down with like a chef's knife and remove the skin, like I don't think he's ever seen anybody do that in real life before. And so I went out and I was like, no, there's no way. He must have. Like, never take for granted what somebody may or may not know in the kitchen. And I went and I did it. And that was his favorite part of the entire thing.
You know what?
He was fascinated by it.
That scene also, he looked so delighted when he was trying it out for himself. Like, it was a magic trick you'd revealed.
I had so much fun with him. Like, he brought, I'm already quite child. I'm definitely a man child. But he brought out, like, that curious, excited boy in me. And I felt like he was a buddy of mine that I've been cooking with like my whole life. And it's just, I just had such a blast. Like it was sheer joy. It was like pure bliss.
The way people talk about food, and I mean, there's this term that's sort of controversial, the whole foodie thing, but people like, there is sort of a status that people sometimes feel like they can achieve by mm-hmm. having culinary knowledge or something like a social status.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that plays into this sort of dynamic that you have of like, yes, I know food, but no, that's not what I'm here to prove.
I mean, yeah, I think my goal is kind of to step back and show, look, already I have a bit of an accent. The fact that I have Polish heritage, raised in Quebec, was in West Virginia for a bit and went to a French boarding school. I pronounce things a little funny because I try to pronounce them in their language of origin. So I get made fun of by my friends for being extremely pretentious with the things that I do. When Ted Allen contacted me, because we were texting a lot during the first season of Queer Eye, he was like, what are you doing this week? And for Corey Waldrop, the cop, I made citrus supremes, where you basically remove all of the pith and all of the fiber, and you have these beautiful citrus segments that are just sort of like the flesh, with an avocado salad, which is like a traditional dish served in a lot of Italian restaurants. I definitely didn't make it up, and I wasn't the first one to ever make it. And Ted made fun of me, and he was like, oh, you pretentious bastard. He's like, you're teaching somebody how to supreme? And then lo and behold, the show comes out, and then there's like this whole other section of people who were like, that's literally, you just made avocados and grapefruit salad. Like, that's the simplest thing. Like, you couldn't go more complicated than that. No, I couldn't. Not for somebody who was too scared of his kitchen and was basically eating in his basement while his wife and daughters were eating upstairs. So it's like, you're never going to make everyone happy.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you've mentioned some aspects of your upbringing, and I want to get into that, into your
sure.
own journey of learning about food, which is in this book. You grew up, as you mentioned, in a Polish household in Montreal.
Very Polish, I would say. It was my first language. For most of my youth, went to church every Sunday, Polish school every Saturday.
What's Polish school like?
Okay, so it was held at in NDG, an area of Montreal, where at a high school called Emily Platter. It was like super, it felt like a time machine in the 60s with like the old Herman Millery desks that are attached to the resin chairs. It was awesome. And Pani Siwikowa, Mrs. Siwik, she was my teacher. She had a beehive and those like triangular upside down sunglasses. And she was the director of the school and my teacher. And my father showed me a photo of hers when she was his teacher, and she had the exact same hairstyle and same glasses and wore the same little two-piece suits.
This reminds me of one of the heroes in Kansas City, or no, in Illinois, in Jonathan Van Ness's hometown.
Yes. Yeah.
But
Kathy Dooley.
Only not Polish in that case.
Not Polish.
Okay, go
in
on.
That
back
case.
To your own upbringing.
Yeah. And she would sit there with like on the chalkboard and just basically write out Polish history. And we had to, in cursive, just copy. And she would just go and write down the board and then erase the whole board and then go like super old school. And then we would learn, basically Polish history and grammar and spelling and syntax and like how to write properly and some religion in there as well, because, you know, Catholicism runs really deep in Polish culture. But and then during the breaks we would have, I just remembered something. So there was a stand. There was this boy, his parents owned a bakery called Wawel, and they made real pączki, which is like the Polish donut filled with a plum marmalade, and they're often cooked in lard and have some like candied orange skins. And I showed up one day and I didn't have money and I wanted to get a donut. And they were like, oh, don't worry about it. Like, oh, you're a Porosky. Your uncle is the board of the school and we know your dad. He comes here often. I have a really big Polish family. They're like, we'll put it on, like, we'll start a credit. So we'll start a tab. I was like, a tab? I was like 7 or 8 years old. I quickly took note of what a tab was and I started buying donuts for all of my friends. And by the end of the semester, I think it was like these donuts were 25 cents and I managed to rack up a bill of like $120 or $30. My parents were furious. And I was just buying treats for everybody because I thought, like, this is so cool. It's like free money. I can
but
just
this
buy
is such an early lesson in the way to someone's heart.
Totally. Well, it's also the need for everyone to love me, I guess, too. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword. Yeah.
But, okay, so Montreal is this incredibly international city. And mm-hmm. you grew up going to Polish school. But you also went to a school all week long where people came from all kinds of different backgrounds. And you write about a yearly event at your school called the Buffet of Nations. Will you talk about that?
So in French, it's the Buffet des Nations. It's, I mean, most of my photos from my classrooms, we probably had about four or five white kids. And then the rest was like kids from all over. And there was this really lovely tradition where our parents would bring dishes from our respective countries and we would sit in the cafeteria. It happened once, maybe twice a year. And everyone would just sort of break bread and share their, like, that's where I tried tadig for the first time, which is like the baked rice dish. It's an Iranian dish that I made for Ari, actually, in an episode of Queer Eye as well. And my mother would bring croquettes, which are crepes filled with mushrooms, but she would make hers with wild mushrooms. And she would do, like,
you guys foraged as a family.
We did.
I'm so jealous.
I loved mushroom picking when I was a kid. It was so much fun because we would, it's something we would all do together, and we would always bring our dog. We always had a miniature dachshund, and then we would come home and then roast some bone marrow, grab some really nice rye bread, and then saute some chanterelles in butter with a bit of like shallot and parsley, and then just have them on toast. And it was like the most magical thing ever. I love wild mushrooms.
I do want to talk to you about this relationship with family and food. You watched your mom cook, but you didn't join her in preparing meals. It's something you talk about regularly on the show, and it's something that appears in this book. And I'm interested in how that dynamic of, like, wanting to get in on the action and watching and waiting for your turn kind of shaped your relationship with cooking.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, with a lot of things that I really love, I love being a student. I love watching, and I think that is a really good way of learning. Before you jump right in, some people tend to think like, no, get your hands right into it from the beginning. But I do think that those years of observing what she did, the way she folded whipped cream and like the way she made bases for sauces and like baked goods during the holidays, I remembered all of that. I really kept it in my little memory bank. There's a lot that I forget in life. Like, I usually don't know what street I'm on or when my next appointment is. I'm like very I can be a little ditzy with things like that. But when it comes to food memories, I remember like one of the first snacks I had as a kid, I was obsessed with bananas. I was obsessed with thinly sliced green apples with Havarti cheese. Like, that was my favorite thing when I was sick at home from school. And I loved watching her cook. And so then when I finally, you know, when I wasn't living with my parents anymore at the age of 17, I did have a little bit of a foundation. And then I just started to kind of like develop it myself. But as much as, and I do go through phases sometimes where I'm like, oh, I wish she did let me cook with her. So I feel like I could have probably learned more and we could have had some really nice experiences. But for whatever reason, I kind of ended up being the same way. And it's something that I'm trying to work on. I want to have my friends help me when I have them over for dinner. Because some of them, you know, when you have somebody over for dinner, some people genuinely want to help. And then other people
are just offering.
They're just offering. And it's like, just have a drink, sit down at the on the kitchen island and just like nosh on some cheese. And like, I got this. Thank you.
I think
but some
it is
people
very,
do want to help.
It is hard to be helped in the kitchen when you have your own pace and your own rhythm that you're used to doing by
Correct.
Yourself. And you just know sort of like in your body when certain things are supposed to happen.
Right. Like, I don't want you to cut the cilantro. It's going to bruise. I want you to just take your index and your thumb and just get the leaves out and then like chop up the stems so we can use those. Don't throw them out. It's like everything is very, I'm particular.
I find it easier to cook with other people when I'm trying something new.
Oh, that's a good idea because you don't have like a preconceived sort of like set of, that's really smart.
Thanks.
I'm going to. Yeah, I think that's a good idea because that also, that's a good way to count. Like, I often will make new dishes for people. Like, you're usually not supposed to try something new out on guests and, like, do something that's been tried, tested, and true. But that's a good opportunity to try something that is neither of those things.
If the whole idea is that you're cooking together, not that you're serving them.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Well, anyway, speaking of basically, like, the dinner party type situation, mm-hmm. a stage in your own cooking journey that really has stuck with me and that feels poignant and relatable and also very particular is that you moved to the States with your dad, but your mom and sisters were still in Canada?
So that those are complicated years in the history of the Porosky family and Anthony specifically. So my sister stayed in Montreal. My father, my mother, and I moved to West Virginia to start junior high. And,
right, okay.
And they were still, my parents always traveled a lot. And then my mother was kind of going back and forth in between our place in Montreal and our place in West Virginia. And then my parents split up after almost 3 years of being in West Virginia. And then I moved to Montreal, but then they got back together, but I was left in Montreal. And then I moved back to West Virginia again for a year. So I moved 3 or 4 times during high school and then ended up back in Montreal again.
But
so.
This is all to say that you started throwing dinner parties at 14.
Yes. Well, they would be followed by ragers. I think it was my own definition of a dinner party. I just took it in the literal sense.
Dinner, then party.
Dinner, then party. And so I would have friends over. And we lived on this golf course resort called Glade Springs. And when we would go to the country club, they had this awesome sandwich with, it was fried oysters with this like raspberry barbecue-y dipping sauce that I really loved. And I wanted to recreate that raspberry barbecue dipping sauce because I didn't know that you can put raspberries and barbecue sauce together and it's perfect because they're tart and acidic and sweet and it kind of works. And so I made my own version and I would marinate chicken breasts and then I would grill them on the oven when my friends would come over and they think they were coming over to just liquidate my parents' stash of Alizé and weird brown rums that they would bring from the Caribbean that no one would usually drink that they probably wouldn't even notice were gone. But they always did. I always got in trouble for it, but I kept doing it anyway. Because at that age, I didn't learn from my mistakes. But my friends were kind of shocked that it was like, oh, wait, like we're sitting down to enjoy a meal. And that was important to me. Like I wanted to have a sit down and just kind of like, there's something about the feeling of like lighting the candles, playing music, enjoying a meal with everybody. Like that's something that I remember growing up that was very, you know.
And you were recreating it with your friends while your family was in this transition.
Yes. Yeah. I missed it. I come from a really messy family and those are like our cherished times are when we were around the table. Even if we would fight, we were all still sitting there together. To have the five of us, my two sisters, my parents and I, at a table with a dog. It was a European household, so the dog was allowed at the table. That was something that I think I've always tried to recreate, and I still continue to in some way, shape, or form, whether it's the heroes on the show or, you know, with the cookbook or even having a restaurant. It's like I love creating that experience.
I love that each of these recipes represents some kind of relationship, whether it's the person who taught you to make something or the person whose taste in food inspired you to learn it.
Mm.
And an example of this that I really appreciated was Rima's masala nuts.
Yeah. So Rima's nuts, I love Rima's mom. She's a sweetheart. This past Mother's Day, she came over with Rima and Rima's daughter, Mara, who's my goddaughter.
And Rima's a friend of yours, right?
Rima's like my best friend. We started, she was running an acting school in New York and I joined and we became very close. And we've been kind of like inseparable ever since, except we're very much separated because I've been working and filming and she's raising a daughter. There was an episode of Queer Eye there was this dish that Rima's mom would make and it was kind of like, it's a street snack. It's something that you have. It's like my equivalent of Marcona almonds, or I have another recipe that's Marcona almonds with a bit of cheese and medjool dates wrapped in prosciutto. And like that was Rima's home's version of that. And you sort of like, there's a bit of technique in there where it's sort of soaking the red onion so that they're not as acrid and then toasting your nuts to get all the oils out so that they get crunchy, which is very important. And learning about sort of like a spice balance. And so that was a dish that for me is like, I don't know, it makes me think of her every time. And it made it to Queer Eye, made it to the cookbook. There aren't too many Queer Eye recipes in there, but there are some that I really wanted to showcase that either didn't make final edits because we didn't have time or that I just felt were really important where there was a nice story.
There's with this recipe and with the what you call the bastardized ramen mm-hmm. and a few others, I really appreciate too that although you are taking international inspiration, there's always an acknowledgement, and this kind of gets back to your relationship with food, not always having to position yourself as the expert with a capital E, that there's a lot of acknowledgement of where the recipe came from, where the flavors came from, and what your relationship to that is and isn't.
Totally. I think, you know, with the bastardized ramen, it's sort of like I want that flavor profile, but at the same time, I wanted a cheap way of doing it at home where I could use a lot more meat and a lot more vegetables, where it wasn't just a massive bowl of broth, because the best thing about ramen is the broth. It's the most important. But when you're doing that at home and you want to make one in 30 minutes and you've had a long day working standard 9-to-6 job, as everyone else in this world is, then it's, you know, you want something that's easy. And I know what good ramen tastes like. I've had the opportunity of trying some of the best, whether it's in Tokyo or in New York. And I just kind of wanted to make my own version of it. And, you know, with Jess, our hero in season three, right?
Two, I think.
No, because Atlanta was one and three. Two, and Kansas City was three. Okay. I forget sometimes, but... And with her, she had instant ramen. I'd actually never tried instant ramen before. And so I wanted to see what that was all about. And I was like, we're not going to take her from instant ramen to basically like making her own bone broth on the first try. Like, this is already somebody who, like, you know, is intimidated by the kitchen. And so I wanted to make an easier version of it that she can share with her friends and have a potluck and ask them to bring other dishes as well. So it was a perfect fit for her, I think.
And your own heritage does come in with this pickled herring tartine recipe that I am going to have to try. Can you talk about that one, including the personal story behind it?
Yes. So I'm trying to remember what I wrote exactly in the book, but I do know my oldest sister, Carolina, is obsessed with herring. When we used to go to... I liked it as well, but I like certain kinds. She likes the more pickly, vinegary ones, and I always like the creamier ones with the sour cream, which kind of seems a weird pairing, but it's very common in Scandinavia and in a lot of parts of Eastern Europe. When we used to go to IKEA as kids, there were two things that I ran towards. One was Daim, which are these like toffee chocolates, spelled D-A-I-M. Most people go for the meatballs. And the second thing was always the jarred herring. They had a lovely selection of pickled herring. Like for Christmas Eve, for example, we don't eat meat as Polish Catholic. And so we have a lot of fish. So we would have like 5 or 6 different types of pickled herring. And my sister, that's something that she would prepare. She's not much of a cook, even though she is now. That's all changed since she got married. See, we can always grow and adapt. But herring was just something that was like so beloved to her. And I just wanted to make something that was like not only the dish itself, because it can be really intense, but decided to kind of morph it into... I love a tartine. I love saying it. I love the taste of it.
I love
the fact that it's just one piece of bread and you have all the ingredients that just kind of hit your lips, so that it's not just a lot of bread and whatever is inside. I much prefer a tartine over a sandwich, and I had to have at least one in the book. And that's it.
And this is pickled herring with tart apple and shaved radishes.
Yeah, it's crunchy. It sort of gives you like all of the... Apples are very commonly used as well, whether you're having, I call it a dry herring, but whether it's like basically like an oily one as opposed to a creamy one. And the radishes add a really nice crunch as well.
And you love frozen peas.
I love frozen peas. I don't eat them frozen, but like I love... There's just... They may be the most nostalgic thing, because I only really started eating them. Wait, did I eat them when I was... No, I didn't eat them in elementary school because I was quite a picky eater. Or I was just a brat and didn't want to eat things that were good for me. But when I moved to New York, and I lived off probably, what, $50, $60 a week, if that, when I was in conservatory, and I had to sort of just do my best. I discovered Trader Joe's, which had like awesome food, and they had really neat cheap peas and Green Giant when they were on sale for 99 cents for the massive family bag. Like, I stocked up on those and I ate a lot of canned tuna, and like frozen peas were part of that. They're ready in 4 or 5 minutes. You add some butter, some salt, get some fresh mint at the store for literally a dollar.
Yes, frozen peas are in this book.
I love frozen peas are in this book.
Yeah. Before we go, we have just a very short time, but is there something about Kansas City's food culture that you think that you as an outsider maybe can recognize and appreciate that a local perhaps doesn't?
That a local doesn't. Well, I feel like locals... Let me think. I will say, as soon as we landed today... We went straight, the first place that we went to. Oh my gosh, I'm forgetting the name right now. The famous, the best pastries ever and the best croissants right on Grand Boulevard.
If you're on Grand and I'm looking at your coffee, did you go to Ibis Messenger?
Messenger, thank you. I went to Messenger every single morning. I just went there with my team who flew in here with me, and we literally had every single pastry and two coffee drinks. And I love everything about Kansas City. It's like, it was such a special place while we were here. I got to meet, I know we talked about Beth Barton, who's a near dear friend of mine. She is a symbol for Kansas City. She's rebellious, charming, kind. And that has been my experience. Like, those are, I feel like, the three keywords for every chef and every food person that I've met in KC while being here.
Our time is up. Antony Perofsky, thanks so much.
That flew by. Thank you so much.
Antony's book is Antony in the Kitchen. The Rainy Day event tonight is sold out. But if you do have tickets, just a reminder, doors open at 6, reading at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. That's a wrap. You can catch anything we talked about today at kcur.org/centralstandard. Later today. And talk to us on Twitter anytime. We're at KCURCST. Tomorrow, fall drinks and Italian food with the food critics. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Ann Kniggendorf, Aviva Okeson Haberman, and intern Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.